Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Phileas Club is entirely financed by its listeners at patreon.com/thePhileas Club. If you think the show is interesting or cool or fun or important to you or brings you anything at all, please do consider going to the website, the Patreon website, and contributing a little bit. That would be immensely appreciated. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode 115. We're in November 2018, and we're going to be talking about chocolate, banks, and cheese. You guessed it, it's the Switzerland special. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. In this show, what we do is that we get people from different parts of the world and we get them together and we discuss what's been happening in the world and try to get a local view on sometimes global events. We get different perspectives and different cultures weighing in on things that are happening. That's what we usually do, but every once in a while we do a special where we focus and zoom in on one topic or country or practice specifically, and this is what we're doing today. This is a special on Switzerland. Basically, we're going to be talking about chocolate and banks for an hour. My name is Patrick Beja, and I'm very glad to be welcoming to the show a real-life Swiss person. Stefan Kolla is here with me. Hi, Stefan. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm so excited to finally find out what happened to all the Nazi gold. So I'm starting like right off the bat. I'm being an a-hole. okay, before we get to all that, so you're Swiss, you've been living there your whole life. You're, as I said, a real life Swiss. Can you tell us maybe a few words about you so people have a little bit of context?
So my name is Stefan, as you mentioned. I'm 38 years old. I was born in Geneva, in the French-speaking part of the country, but actually I became a real Swiss only when I was 8. Before that, I was Italian, like both of my parents were. I work in the IT, in a bank, you know, talk about the cliché. and I like tech, video games, books, podcasts, all the geeky stuff.
Right. And by the way, I thank you for your support of my efforts. Is very much appreciated. Well. So, you know what? We are going to be talking about banks, of course, and probably chocolate and the very strange patchwork that Switzerland is, with so many different languages and basically cantons are states, I guess. Can we say states? It's not quite states, but it's a federation. Switzerland is a federation.
Yeah, exactly. It's a confederation, and states might be the closest thing people understand cantons. Yeah.
Right. So we'll talk about all of this, but I think I'm going to start with a topic that honestly might seem controversial, but I think it's actually really interesting. And that is the topic of guns and gun ownership in Switzerland. When we were preparing the show, we discussed this a little bit. And I mean, it has to do with the military, of course, but can you tell us, basically, in your words, what the situation is with guns, which is linked to the military service and the military life. Essentially, Switzerland is a giant militia, is what I took away from it. You have the most guns of almost any country in your homes all the time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Every boy, every Swiss boy, has to do either the national service in military or civilian service when he reaches 18. And basically, they have to do it. If you don't do it, you have to pay. And every soldier receives a weapon, receives a gun, or even an assault rifle. So, and we bring that home. Because since we're a militia, if we have to defend the country, we have to be ready to be called. So yeah, 3.5 million of guns are staying in everyone's home, actually in Switzerland, currently in Switzerland. Almost 50% of the population has got an assault rifle, a gun. And as you mentioned, we're third in terms of numbers of guns per citizen behind Yemen and the US. So it's very strange that nothing bad happens.
And that's the most puzzling thing, because you mentioned when boys and men have to go do the military service, they receive a service weapon, usually an assault rifle, and they bring it home, but it's not just for the duration of the military service. And I think that's the most surprising thing, and the reason the numbers go high up so much, it's that you keep it, correct me if I'm wrong, but you keep it until you're like, what, 35, and you're not in active, semi-active duty anymore, correct?
Exactly. That's correct.
So any family with at least one man that is under 35 is most likely in possession of an assault rifle in the home.
Exactly.
That is incredible. You're saying 3.5 million weapons. That means that, you know, the country is what, 8.5 million people?
Yeah, roughly.
So that means essentially every home probably has a gun, at least one weapon in the home.
Yeah, at least one, and probably even two or three, depending on the number of sons in the home.
So a lot of people think about guns, and obviously our mind goes to the US, and think, well, one of the issue, the main issue with death, gun-related deaths and accidents in the US is the fact that there are so many guns. This is an example that could contradict that assumption. But how do you explain? Because my understanding is there aren't really any issues with gun violence, I think.
No. There's no mass shooting and barely any death by guns on a yearly basis. I mean, 30 or 40 top, and most of them are suicide, I guess.
So how do you explain that?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, in my opinion, it's a different of mindset. Guns are not seen as a tool of power here. They're more seen like a responsibility. And when you are given your gun in the army, they tell you that this is very dangerous, that you have to train on a yearly basis. We have to go to a shooting range and train ourselves. They tell you that this is something you have to be very, very cautious with. It's a different mindset, I guess. That's the only reason I can think of.
Sure the mindset. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. I mean, it also may be linked to the Swiss mentality. We're more strict and more rigorous than others. But you know, that may not be the only thing. It's probably this mindset.
I think, you know, another aspect that might be very integral to the way you approach this whole aspect of your life, because for many people, and just to be sure, it doesn't concern women. Women don't do civil or military service at all, I'm guessing, unless maybe they want to. But
exactly. If they want to, they can do it, but it's not mandatory for them.
Okay. And before I go to my point, you also mentioned if you don't do it, you can refuse to do it, but you have to pay 3% of your income
Yeah.
Basically forever, or until 35, maybe?
Exactly, until you reach 35 or 40, depending. Yeah.
That's a lot of money, 3%.
Yeah.
So I
yeah.
guess most people choose to do it. But I mean, you quickly mentioned that there's training, and I think that's also quite important. It's not just training when you receive the weapon when you're 18. You also train, you said, every year until you are not in semi-active duty anymore, right?
Exactly. That's correct. Yeah.
What kind of training does that, you know, what does that imply? What do you do? You just go shoot your gun three times in a shooting range, or what does it mean?
Well, there's that. You've got to go to the shooting range and reach a certain score. If you don't reach it, you have to shoot again. And there's also those 3 weeks of military service you have to do also every year.
Year? Wait, that I didn't. You do 3 weeks every year?
Yeah, until you reach more than 240, I guess. I don't remember the exact number, but 240 days in the military, and then you're done, or until you reach 35.
And you have to do those 3 weeks every year?
Yep. If you're working or if you're studying, you can ask for a recess, so you can ask to do it the next year, but you have to pay a tax.
The 3%. Wow. Yeah. All of a sudden.
You get it back once you're done your days, but still.
Okay. And are you paid during those 3 weeks or?
Not really. Yeah. You get a little bit money back, but not 100% of your income.
Because that's, I mean, losing a month worth of income is significant for.
Well, actually, there's an insurance that guarantees you that you get 80% of your income.
Oh,
okay. Not 100%.
So it's essentially integrated into the system, and you are getting money from your insurance, essentially.
It's a national insurance. Yeah.
Okay, I see. I guess, you know, that aspect of it might be a good explanation for why things don't go awry with that many guns in the country. I mean, if you have to train that much when you get it, and then every single year for 3 weeks, and going to the shooting range, and I'm guessing during those 3 weeks, it's not just shooting the gun, but it's drilling into you the importance of military action and all of this. So,
yeah, actually, might help, but I'm not sure it's the only reason, but definitely helps.
So that mindset that you're talking about, there's the Swiss are quite, at least in my image, they're a little bit German-like and good. You know, rigorous people who work hard and do things the proper way, and that is what I understand when you say, well, there's a certain mindset that people have that maybe influences that aspect of it. How true is it that the Swiss are serious and rigorous and all that? In your vision, in your view, of course, you're in the middle of it, so.
Yeah, in my view, it's not that far from the truth. We are probably a little bit more rigorous or stricter than others. But the funny thing is, you mentioned the patchwork that the Switzerland is,
and the patchwork, you mean?
Yeah, the patchwork. Yeah, mm-hmm. And the German part of the Switzerland is what we consider to be extremely rigorous, strict, and etc. Mm. On the Italian and the French part, yeah, not that much. Probably not that much.
So actually, you know what? Let's go back a little bit. Some people might not really know how Swiss is made or organized. You mentioned German, French, and Italian parts. Yeah. And we talked about the canton or the states. Tell us what Swiss is from an organization and identity standpoint.
Okay, so Switzerland is basically a confederation of 26 cantons. We mentioned that before, though. Those are like mini states or things like that. The country is divided in between four linguistic regions. The biggest one is the German part. It represents roughly 2/3 of the Swiss people. Then there's the French part and the Italian part. There's a very small region that speaks a different language called the Romanche, but it's only composed by 25,000 people, something like that. So it's an official language, but it's nearly not spoken anymore. What can I tell you? Each canton is very independent at its own level. They can like collect taxes, they define education, they manage transport and things like that. Basically, they're very, very autonomous.
So the education is set differently in every one of the 26 cantons.
Yep. For example, in the canton that's the neighbor of Geneva, in Canton Vaud, they study 1 year less than we do in Geneva.
Oh, wow. So it's even the length of the...
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do you have then, like, each canton has their own minister of education, or I don't know how it would be defined, but do you have your own government? It goes beyond states in the sense that it's not just a number of state representatives or whatever. You actually have some tiny government to administrate all of these aspects.
Maybe
in other countries, or maybe the US, I'm thinking of federal countries, maybe it's actually the case and I don't realize it, but so you have people in charge of all of those things specifically.
Yeah, each canton has its own government. Naturally, at some point, we have to agree on some basic rules. So if I want to go and work in Zurich or in Basel, I can do that with my degree. But the specifics are defined at the canton level.
So that was going to be my next question. What is common, then, between all of the cantons and the country? What makes Switzerland Switzerland?
That's very difficult to answer.
Cheese and chocolate, obviously, and banks, but
cheese, chocolate, banks, Roger Federer, things like that. No, I'm joking, but not that. It's not that a joke. I mean, it's very hard to define what it is to be a Swiss. And usually, when we think about it, when we talk about it amongst each other, we define us by deciding what we are not. The French part of Switzerland is not France. We're not French, and the German part acts the same way with Germany, and also it's the Italian part. They're not Italian. They're Swiss Italian. So that's one way to define it.
That's interesting. I sense a little bit of. So obviously you're from the French part.
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
I sense a little bit of disdain. When you're saying we're not French, it's like like anything but French. We're not like those savages. We're Swiss, and that's when like is there a little bit of contempt towards, or I don't know, maybe that's a strong word, but
no, I wouldn't say that. I'd say it's the other way around. I mean, France is often perceived. I'll talk about France since I'm living in the French part of Switzerland. France is often perceived as a big disdainful brother. You know, they barely know we exist. We speak the same language, but they barely know we exist. So yeah.
The same language. You speak funny. I have to admit. But yeah, sure.
Exactly. That's part of the problem. No, but we don't. Yeah, you like to be what you are. You like to be yourself, and you don't like when German. When we travel abroad, let's put it that way. When we travel abroad and we speak French, most of the time people say, "Oh, you're from France, Paris," and well, we don't really like that. So that's why I say that we define us by what we're not, and no, we're Swiss. But it's not disdainful, I guess.
Okay, that's interesting. I guess there are some commonalities with Belgium. We talked about Belgium a few months ago with Guillaume, and. Yep. I guess there's a lot of things, you know, there's the federal nature and the different languages. And do you feel like you're the two little brothers, or do you not see any relation with Belgium in that sense?
So I definitely see relations with Belgium and with Quebec.
Right.
So, you know, when we meet a Belgian, say, oh, yeah, those French, huh? Wink, wink.
I see. So, okay, for the identity part, I can see maybe how that would work. From an administrative standpoint, if, as you mentioned, I guess there's the military that is handled from the Confederation level. What else is common? Like, what does the Confederate government do?
They manage foreign affairs. Like, when you have to talk with the other country, you can't ask
26
Emmanuel Macron to talk with 26 people. Mm-hmm. So there's also finances. The justice system is there are local tribunals, but a courthouse, but there's also a federal courthouse. They also manage environment, energy, and you know those big things. They do it at the confederation level. Mm. The rest is at the cantons.
I guess the police force as well, or maybe not actually.
No, there are two police levels. Yeah, canton and federal.
Oh, so there are two levels. Okay.
Yeah, military, for example. Yeah.
Oh, military, of course, yeah. But I was thinking about the local police services. Those also, there are two organizations.
Yeah, cantonal police, yeah.
Okay. Does it ever clash? Like, I'm guessing sometimes the canton's elected officials are not in the same, political family or don't have the same political ideas as the Confederate one. How does that work?
When it does, because it does happen, obviously, we treat the problem at the cantonal level, and we are autonomous. Yeah, let's say that we're autonomous enough to define laws at the cantonal level. So if we don't think that the confederal level does it good, we can do it at a cantonal level.
I'm thinking about things like that are outside the reach of a cantonal level, maybe to get back to controversial topics, things like immigration, although I'm guessing Switzerland doesn't open the borders at all. Maybe it's a preconceived idea, but these kinds of things, I'm guessing you're quite protective of your borders.
Depends. Actually, 25% of people living in Switzerland are not Swiss. So it depends how you want to put it that, but a quarter of the people living in Switzerland are not Swiss. Mm. So I don't know if you consider that immigration.
I was thinking about refugees and things like that, which is the hot topic in the rest of Europe and the world probably at the moment, but
we get some, but since we're not part of the Europe, we can't any, you know, we don't have a word on how many we get, and you know, we're out of the European Union, so we get some, but probably not as many as Germany, for example.
And that's not a controversial discussion in the country, like, because in Europe, obviously, because of the open borders, it's always at the, you know, a topic that people at least think about and often discuss. Is that not a conversation that is happening in Switzerland?
Oh, yeah, it is. It is highly controversial.
Okay.
It is highly controversial.
We don't need to get into that specifically because I think it's the same everywhere, but I want to get to the relationship with Europe. Because I think that's an interesting one as well. But before we do that, let's talk about banks for a little bit. I've teased this in the beginning. So the image, like the caricatural image that we have outside of Switzerland, is banks have a tradition of being extremely secretive, of having taken Nazi gold, very often the gold that the Germans took from the Jewish community, and they stored it in Switzerland. And essentially, the country is often regarded as living off of the illicit gains of illicit people in the world who store their money in Switzerland. I mean, I don't think you can say definitively whether or not that's the case, but what do you think of that that perception? Is it annoying to Swiss people, or is there some truth to it? I don't know. What can you tell me?
Oh, no, there's some truth to it. I mean, there's been many reports regarding specifically this this Nazis gold, as it has been called, that came out in the 90s. So what you're saying basically is true, but let's say that half of the people here agree with you, fully agree with you, and the other half say that this is a caricature and things have been changing. And to be honest, things have been changing for the past 10 years or 15 years.
Just to be clear, when you say some people disagree, does everyone agree that the Swiss banks housed the Nazi gold, but then disagree that the situation is still the same? Or do some people say, oh, no, we never got the Nazi gold, or we never got those things, and that's, you know, made up stories?
No, it's the first one. You know,
everyone agrees on the facts.
They have to agree on the facts, at least.
Well, I mean, a few years ago, I would have said, yes, of course, everyone has to agree on the facts. But nowadays, I'm not sure that sentence actually, you know, means something. Okay, so the stories from the past, you know, 50 years or so are established, but you're saying that things have been changing in the past 15 years?
Yeah, 10 to 15 years. Banks, I mean, due to the pressure of the United States and the Europe on Switzerland, they say, okay, now you can't go on with your financial, with your banking secrecy. You have to open up even a little bit, otherwise you'll be considered as a paradise, you know, like Bermuda.
Fiscal paradise, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, banks had to open. They had to collaborate on legal inquiries by different countries. And since 2018, so this was the first year, banks started sending data to different ministries, like Bercy in Paris. Data
so
from
Ministry of Finance in France.
Exactly, from the customers.
So from what customers, sorry?
For the banks sent data regarding their customers to the financial ministry in the different countries.
Really? Like, yeah. I'm guessing from customers that are of that the nationality.
Obviously. They send the name, the amount, the number of gains and losses and things
like
that.
Oh wow! For every citizen of that country?
Yeah,
that's. I didn't realize. That is crazy. That means there is like zero secrecy in Switzerland if you're from a country that has those agreements, I'm guessing.
Excellent. That's the first caveat. You have to be part of the list of countries we signed an agreement with. And funny things, it doesn't work in Switzerland. We still have the banking secrecy for Swiss residents.
All right. Fair enough. So I guess if... you want the full package, you have to become Swiss, which actually we might get into in a little bit. How difficult is it to become a Swiss citizen? But so I have a question about the things we see in movies, and maybe you can't really tell if it's true or not. What about those numbered accounts? Like, there are accounts that only have a number and no name attached to it, and you can access it if you have the number and the super secret code, and that's it, which seems like pretty bad from a security standpoint. But does that exist at all?
You mean the guy crossing the border with the raincoat, sunglasses, with a suitcase full of banknotes? And
well, I mean, maybe not even that far. I'm guessing that doesn't really happen anymore. Although, you know what? I don't know. Do people actually show up at a bank with, if I show up with $500,000 in cash, can I open an account?
Nope, you can't.
Oh.
No, you can't.
Oh, that's disappointing.
No. I'm sorry. No, but there are anti-money laundering laws, and they've been hardened during the last, let's say, 20, 25 years. Now you have to provide additional information, like, of course, your name, where you come from, where you live, etc., but also where the money comes from, etc. So you can just pop up with $500,000 and up on an account.
Okay. Well, it was my lemonade stand at, like, in Paris. I made a lot of it doesn't
sorry.
Work. What about the numbered account though? Like, does that actually exist?
Yeah, they do, but they have to be linked to a physical person.
How does that, like, okay, what does it make, what makes it numbered? If it has to be linked to a physical person, it's the same as any account, because any account has a number.
Yeah, it's just an ID. You can't have just an account with money on it and you don't know who it belongs to.
That's, okay.
Yeah, impossible.
Okay, so I guess those things have to happen in the Cayman Islands or something like that.
Yeah,
nowadays.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. The relationship with Europe, I kind of mentioned earlier. Oh, actually, how do you become Swiss? Is it are the Swiss super protective of their country and they don't want, you know, all of those dirty Europeans, or maybe even worse, you know, like brown and black people to become Swiss? Or is this now I'm caricaturing, you know, obviously, but actually, well, I'm sure some people in France would like to become Swiss for some reason or another. I'm guessing it's an attractive country to be living in, and the citizenship is hard to get.
I didn't go through the process since I was only 8, so I can't really tell you, but there are some criteria. You have to live here for 12 years, I think it is. 10 or 12 years. You have to work, and then you have to request for Swiss citizenship. It takes up to 2 years, on 2.5 years. You have to pass tests to prove you can speak one of the national languages, that you know the culture, the history, etc. of Switzerland.
That seems pretty reasonable.
Yeah, I can say if it's hard. I'm guessing it's easier than the U.S. citizenship, but I don't really know.
Oh, actually, there's one thing I heard, which is, when you request the citizenship, maybe it's different in different cantons, but the authorities actually come ask your neighbors if they like you or something like that. Have you heard of this? Maybe it's too far away from you.
No, I've heard of this, and I'm one of the, how can I say that? I'm one of the name, one of my friends, a French friend, has given
as a reference, I guess.
Yeah, as a reference, yeah.
So you actually have to get references from Swiss citizens that say,
"Yeah, you do.
Yeah, that dude or that girl's okay. They can, that would be fine."
Yeah, you have to give 5 names, and they may be called or may not. Depends on your appliance.
Interesting. So I guess it means it forces you to have at least some ties in the community.
Oh yeah.
It seems a bit stringent, but maybe that's a good way of making sure you're integrated, I suppose.
Yeah, there's an infamous story of an English girl that has been living in I think it was in Gladys, for more than 30 years, and has been refused the nationality because she didn't like cows. You know, she didn't like the sound of the bells on the cows, and she made petitions to remove them. So the local administration said, that's not very Swiss-like.
That's actually, that's funny. So it's not just that she didn't like cows. She actually went and did some kind of action to try and alter
the... Yeah.
You're mentioning cows and bells. The cows and milk and cheese, of course, are part of the image of Switzerland. How urban is the country? I think there are lots of mountains, but do you have, is it, because it feels like the country is not very large, although to be fair, the population is much higher than the one for the country I'm currently living in, Finland. So, but for some reason, I still have the image of Switzerland being tiny. Like, is it mostly cities? Is it mountains? Does everyone have a chalet? How do you call it in English? A house in the mountains for skiing? How does that work?
I'd say 50-50 between cities and countryside. In the mountains, there are not that many people living because Alps are pretty high and pretty cold, so we don't live there. I'd say 50-50. Some cantons are very rural, and others are mostly one big city like Geneva, or there's also Zurich, Baselstadt. Basel has got a canton that's only one city. So depends, but I'd say 50-50. I don't have the numbers in mind.
Geneva is the image I have of Switzerland. So
maybe Geneva is a canton city. There's only one big city, a little bit of countryside here and there, but it's only mainly a city.
Hey, do you speak German?
Yeah, I do a little bit.
How does it work? We talked about this when we were discussing Belgium as well. How does it work when you meet a not a German, but a German Swiss, and they don't speak French or you don't speak German? Like, is it? I have a hard time, since I've always lived in countries where everyone spoke the same language. It would seem to me like they somehow, it becomes tense very quickly, like, oh, you don't speak. Actually, I'm saying this here, some people speak Swedish. My wife speaks Swedish in Finland, which the country has two languages. So I didn't even think of that. But anyway, how does it work when you meet someone who doesn't speak French?
Yeah, that's a shameful part, because we've been taught German for 9 years. In school, and almost no one can speak a word because we don't use it on a daily basis. So we often end up speaking English among each other.
Really?
That's sad. Yeah. Either the German speaker switches to French. They tend to do that, or we try a little bit of German, and if we don't understand each other, we switch to English.
What about the Italians, though?
Yeah, they often have to speak at least one other language. Most of the time it's French, but I do also speak Italian, but because both of my parents are Italian, but that's another story.
So you cheated, basically.
Yeah.
So it's not uncommon for Swiss people to speak English amongst themselves.
Nope, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That's what Guillaume was saying about Belgium as well. So we covered banks, we covered guns, we covered money, and what about the relationship to Europe? Because, again, if some listeners don't know, obviously Switzerland is not part of the EU, it is independent, and it has the most defining characteristic of the Swiss policy history has been neutrality. Swiss has been the one country that says we don't take part in any conflict, which obviously led to issues with the in World War II, or maybe not issues but stories. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship between Switzerland and the EU?
Okay, so this one's tricky because on one hand we voted twice, once in the 90s and once in 2001. And we refused to be part of the EU. So twice we said no, we don't want to be part of the EU, doesn't work for us, we don't want it. We want to stay neutral and outside of the EU.
I'm guessing if there were two votes, there were at least a portion of the population who was thinking it would be a good idea to join.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, actually, the first time it was the federal government that said, okay, we'd like to be part of the EU, we'd like to request for to enter the EU. And there is a minority of people that launched what we call an initiative. So they said that we don't want that. So we are going to ask people for signatures. And if we reach a certain level, we're going to vote. And the whole country, the whole Swiss people in living in the country, because foreigners can vote, will decide if we agree with you or if we say that we don't want to request to join the EU.
Wait, sorry. So first of all, it was on rails to be... Switzerland was going to join the EU, or at least that's what the government was talking about.
The government was talking about it, and since it's a big change, you know, you had to get agreement from the people, basically.
And that's another. And you mentioned foreigners can vote as well.
Yeah.
Even on such big things, I'm guessing you have to have a permanent residency to vote.
Oh, you have to be Swiss. That's part of the problem. I mentioned 25% of the people living here are not Swiss.
Oh, so I misunderstood. I thought you said they can vote. Yeah.
Okay. No, they can't. Sorry.
Of course. Okay. But then you talked about an initiative? Like anyone can start a poll to decide to launch a vote on an issue, and if you get a certain number of signatures, then what, the whole canton has to vote, or the whole country? How does it work?
Yeah, depends on the level of your initiative. If you're trying to change something at the cantonal level, like in education, for example, then you have to get few thousand signatures. If you're trying to change something at the national level, then it's much higher. It's 100,000, I guess, you have to collect within 1 year. And if you succeed, then the whole country votes.
So I guess I have two questions. First, you must be voting all the time about everything. If it's only 100,000 signatures out of 8 million people, it's not easy, but it's not difficult to get. And the second question is, what's the dumbest thing you've ever had to vote on? Because that must happen often as well.
So, yeah, we are voting a lot, once every 3 months. So, you know, four times a year. Yeah, yeah, we do vote on several objects, not on one single object, several objects every 3 months. And we did vote on things that are huge, like, do you want to be part of the United Nations? Do you want to be part of Europe? And we also vote on trivial things that we should probably not, because we don't know anything about, or it's a little bit stupid. The example I mention almost all the time is those minaret votation a few years ago. You know, minarets on the mosques, those towers in the mosques.
Mm-hmm.
Someone decided that they were an issue. There were only four of them in Switzerland. They decided that it was an issue, and they wanted to install a ban on new minarets. So they got their signatures, we voted, and we decided that, yes, it was an issue, so it's now forbidden to build new ones. I don't really see how that's a big issue enough to bring voters to the booth, but yeah, so that's a little bit stupid, in my opinion.
Okay. I was hoping for something like actually completely ridiculous, like should dogs be allowed to bark or something.
I've got one. Oh, I didn't mention it because it's coming on the 23rd of November, but we're going to vote on cows' horns.
What?
Yeah, do you want to, because now the horns of the cows are removed when they're, you know, baby. I don't know, you mentioned veal. Is that veal? Yeah.
Yeah.
Some guy decided that this was not correct for them, and we want to ban this thing, and we want people to leave the horns on cows. So we're going to vote on the 23rd of November on this issue.
Because it's animal cruelty, or?
Yeah, because it's animal cruelty, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I think maybe it is. I maybe it is animal cruelty. Maybe the cows would be happier with their horns. Maybe more dangerous. Maybe that would be an issue. But
exactly, that's part of the problem, in my opinion. You say, oh, animal cruelty, that's bad. But I'm not a farmer, so I don't know why they do that. And when you talk with farmers, you say, okay, they can hurt themselves with the horns, so they don't. It's not cruelty at all. And it's actually more dangerous for them with the horns on.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess, yeah, that it's actually not a ridiculous question. I mean, it's ridiculous that you would ask the entire country to vote on something like this when you don't really know why or how it works. And I'm guessing you actually mentioned it when we were preparing the show. That happens often then. You often are asked your opinion on things you don't understand.
Yeah, and see, I'm just sorry, but we're voting on this horn thing, but at the same time, on the same votation, we have to decide if we want the laws of our country to be predominant in regard of the international laws. So, do you want to say that the laws defined by international treaties are less important than the Swiss laws? So if we say yes, we might decide that we don't want to be part of the
say it in French if you want, then I can.
La CEDH, la Cour européenne des droits de l'homme, the human rights.
The Court of Human Rights, European exactly. Courts of Human Rights.
Yeah. And we're voting on both those objects at the same time, and I mean you can see that this is very different in terms of impact.
And it's difficult to understand the issue and the question that is being asked. How many questions do you have to answer? And I'm guessing it's yes or no each time.
Yeah, it's a yes or no.
How many questions do you have to answer in each of those, you know, quarterly votation, since that's the name?
Depends. Can be 2, 3, can be 12, 13, not all of them at the country level. Most of the time it's at the canton level or even at the smaller level.
I mean, there is something beautiful about this level of direct democracy. And I'm guessing even though not everyone understands everything about all the questions, the Swiss people, I would guess, are more aware and educated about these questions than people would be in most other countries where this doesn't happen.
I hope so, but I'm not so sure. For example, the women were given the right to vote at the canton level. The last canton level was in 1991. See, yeah, that's makes you laugh, but
and
they didn't even vote yes. It was the federal courthouse that told them that this was unconstitutional to refuse women the right to vote.
In 1991
at the canton level, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I mean obviously there are issues with the system. And I'm the biggest one is voting on so many things that you can't be informed about all of them. And maybe even, you know, if it's big things like that are controversial, people are aware of them, at least, even if they're not informed. I'm thinking, the things that come to mind are maybe the minarets or things about immigration or whatever, things that make the headlines. But there might be things that people don't actually care about all that much and that would be better left to the administrators who understand the issue to make a decision, things like the cow horns that, you know, on a basic level, you're like, oh, well, animal cruelty, then maybe we shouldn't do it. It's an old way of doing things and we should be nicer to the animals now. But actually, you don't understand. It's better for them to be dehorned. So just so I have a clear image of how that works before we move on, every 3 months, everyone in the country goes to their voting place and has a small paper where you check yes or no. I mean, I say everyone, I'm guessing not everyone does it, or maybe it's mandatory, I don't know. But you have the whole administrative organization that takes care of this every 3 months and everyone goes to fill their paper? Or do you do it, what, online, or do you send it by mail, or how does it work in practice?
In practice, there are, as you mentioned, booths, a place where you go and you can vote in person. You can send it by mail, and in some cantons, there's a pilot for online voting, and it's not mandatory.
Oh, so you don't have to do it?
No, you don't have to do it.
Do you know how many people do it in general? On an average thing, you know, not on a controversial issue.
On an average, not that many. It depends on the objects. The most controversial, like do you want to be part of the Europe? They often reach 70%, 75%, or 60%, roughly. And when there's almost nothing important, in our opinion, we're around 35-40%.
Interesting. So even the most important ones only get to 65-70%.
Yeah.
Do you have, like, I'm going to sound stupid, I'm sure, but presidential elections or, like, representative elections? That's on top of the votations, I guess.
Yeah, that's the thing. On top of votation, we also vote to elect people at the canton level and at the federal level. So we vote even more.
Right. And do you know how much participations those get?
That I don't know, no. But okay. I'm guessing not that much. Let's see.
Okay. Are you politically, well, not you, but the Swiss, are you politically conscious, active? Or is it like, well, the system works, whatever, I'm going to go have a beer? Like, what's the mood about political engagement? I'm not saying activism or militant actions, just... It's important to vote because, as I often say, in France, we are politically minded, I think, and at the very least, people do understand the importance of voting for the presidential election and often for the other ones as well. But the presidential elections, I think, rarely go under 80% of participation. It's not the case for all of them, but...
I couldn't tell. I'm guessing since people know that we vote often and we will keep doing that for the years to come, I'm guessing when you don't feel a certain passion for an object, you will not vote. You say, oh, bah, I don't care what's the outcome. Okay. So, yeah.
Yeah, it seems understandable. All right. Well, I guess we're not too far away from the end. If there's anything you want to add, let me know, and then I'll ask like a bonus question. But is there any Swiss-specific topic that we didn't cover, maybe that has to do with cheese or... No, I'm going to stop. Now, like any specific things you'd like to cover that we didn't talk about?
No. I guess we covered a lot of topics. Just one quick note. I know that this is something that... It's important to you. I just wanted to mention that we don't have universal healthcare in Switzerland.
Oh, so, you mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not universal healthcare, but the way you described it made it feel like kind of universal healthcare without it being managed by the state.
Exactly.
Essentially... Well, you can explain how it works. I will.
Essentially, private companies provide services as defined by the law. It's the minimum thing you have to cover. And then if you want additional coverage, like dental care, that is not mandatory, you have to pay additional fees.
So I guess the companies that provide the basic healthcare are extremely regulated.
Not that much, no. They are a private company. They have to cover certain services, but they can fix the price as they see fit.
But do you have things like, when we talk about healthcare, obviously we think about the US and some of the issues that we see in the American healthcare system, there are a few, and I think the key point, which I'm going to get to afterwards, makes this system very different for countries that don't have healthcare or, you know, nationalized healthcare. But one of the things we talk about when we think of the US system is things like lifetime limits. I can't remember the name. Like pre-existing conditions are a factor, and they might be allowed to not cover you if you have pre-existing conditions. And the other thing is, well, we'll cover you up to $400,000 or $1 million and nothing more.
No, that would be illegal. That would be illegal here.
So in that sense, it is regulated. The other thing is, which you mentioned, everyone has to contract an insurance, right?
Yes.
Right.
That's right.
And that's the big difference. So the healthcare system, companies can do it, but it's regulated, and some of the what might be considered bad practices are banned, and it's mandatory for everyone to contract a healthcare insurance. So essentially, it's not socialized healthcare, but it's mandatory healthcare. So I think it is something that, you know, the way it's different from the way it works in other countries is almost trivial, not quite, because it's still companies. But I think, if you know, in France, as you mentioned, we have a basic healthcare that is nationalized and everyone gets it and everyone has to pay for it. And then what you get, which is for additional services, we also have. It's called Mutuel, which is essentially additional healthcare, and that you can decide to take or not. And it's also provided by private companies, but they are heavily regulated, just like the basic system is regulated in Switzerland. So it's not that different, I think.
Oh yeah, so I guess that's cool. Yeah, I just wanted to mention that this one is not a state insurance, right, but a private company.
Right, right. And I think, you know, I think there's an argument to be made that private companies might run things better than the state. I mean, you can debate that, but I really think that the important part of your system is that it's regulated and mandatory. So all the rest is kind of fluff around it. But
perfect.
Yeah. all right. So my two questions that I would like to finish with. The first one is, in your lifetime as a Swiss person, what is the event you remember that made you feel, and the country feel, proud to be Swiss? And maybe the thing that was super controversial and that divided the country very much in your lifetime?
Ooh, the second one... I guess the second one is related to votations, and yeah, it might be this minaret thing, because it was so trivial and it has sent a very strong message I did not agree on. But yeah, I don't know the first one.
To play devil's advocate and to give you a little bit of time to think about something that makes you proud to be Swiss. Come on, there has to be one thing. I can understand, even if I disagree with, I can understand the idea that minarets change the, you know, if you're that, you have a stick up your ass about bells on cows, there's something cultural about it. And minarets, do they call for prayer from the minarets?
No, it's forbidden.
Okay, it's not allowed. The calls aren't allowed. So it was really just an architectural thing. I guess, yeah, I can see how people would think, well, it changes the cultural landscape, and also it means more Muslims in the makeup of our society, which, again, we could talk about for hours. I wouldn't really agree, but I understand where they're coming from. All right.
Regarding the pride part, I can't tell you. Maybe that's what being Swiss means. I don't know, something I'm proud of. Again, I could mention Roger Federer, I could mention sport events, but yeah, I don't know.
Eating chocolate or maybe the fact that you're reserved and quiet and serious and working, and you don't have time for such frivolities as being happy about stuff.
I don't know. Honestly, I can't tell you something. I mean, I don't consider I have to be proud of being a Swiss. I mean, I was born here, so I'm just what I am. So no, I can't tell you.
Interesting.
Sorry.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. It's the lack of answer is just as interesting as the answer would be. So on that note, I would like to thank you very much for spending a little bit of time with me and the listeners to let us know about your country. Do you have any online activity that you would like to share and get people to come and check out?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Steph Sinalco.
I will put the link to your Twitter account in the show notes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. For me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And by Not Patrick, I mean Not Patrick. You know, Patrick with a not in front of it. It's very clever because everyone remembers it. You can also come and comment on the show at frenchspin.com. You'll find this show over there, and you'll also find a show about gaming called Pixels, and that is what you'll find there. So this episode was a little bit of a break from the craziness of the world. Hopefully you had a good time changing your, you know, the mood about things. And next time, at the end of the month, we'll have an episode where we dive back into the insanity that 2018 still is. And, well, I mean, I won't say what we'll talk about, but we'll talk about things that are concerning, as usual. And that illicit debate. Maybe I should say that rather than concerning. But you'll see, it's not necessarily what you're thinking about. Anyway, if you enjoy the show, or if you think it's an important show for you, or if you think it's valuable in any way, you know what you can do? You can support it with your monies at patreon.com/thephidiasclub. It's very easy. Everyone knows Patreon, how it works, so I won't go over that. But I will remind you that this show exists without sponsors or third parties or interests. We don't take money from PACs or from, lobbyists. We just tell you the truth the way it is for real. And if you want to support that, you can go to patreon.com/thephidiasclub. The link is also in the show notes, so go check that out. And we will be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you then. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.